I'm here with Helen Lewis. Helen, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So I've been a fan for quite some time. I have not read everything you've written or heard everything you've said, but I've been following you. I think it has been 4 or 5 years or so. How long have you been at The Atlantic?
Yeah, since 2019, so about then.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe we can start with your background as a journalist before we launch ourselves into the whole catastrophe, which is modern politics and culture war issues. How would you describe your focus as a writer and journalist?
These days, I'm more and more interested in reporting. I don't know about you, but I kind of went through a phase where I felt like I'd gorged on opinions. I sort of thought everyone in the world has many opinions. I have many, many opinions. But actually, to me, the hard work of journalism is going out there, talking to people, finding out facts, writing them down, publishing them. All of which are, I think, a lot more difficult than sometimes people would think. You know, I always think of sort of Rashomon as being the model for journalism, is you can get the same event that is reported by people who are there in the room into you completely different ways. And that is, you know, that is really hard intellectual work to do, to try and sort out what actually happened from among this conflicting mess of all the people's versions of reality. So that's the stuff I'm most interested in doing at the moment. The Atlantic gives me a berth to do that. It also gives me a berth to do commentary, which is my kind of natural home. I started out as a copy editor, but I became a writer now over a decade ago. And I've always been somebody who has been quite free with their opinions. But yeah, I think you can overdose a bit, can't you?
Do you write pieces that are, in your view, ever free of commentary and opinion, and it's just actually straight reporting? Or you're definitely, everything I've read from you, it seems to be on the, at least it has a foot in the opinion side of the journal.
Yeah, I can't do that. I really respect people who are just hardcore reporters, you know, and they really work a beat really hard, and they go in and they just, you know, try not to put any of themselves into it. But I've never managed to do that. I think, you know, my natural tendency is often towards snark. So quite often snark creeps in there. But I don't think that's necessarily a bad response. You know, my model of journalism is being the boy in the emperor's new clothes, right? You're the one who has to stand in the middle of everyone else, and everyone else is saying that they're having a wonderful time and everything's brilliant, and you have to be the one that points out, no, the emperor's naked. So having a kind of snarky British sensibility, I think, kind of helps. I mean, maybe some of the stuff we'll come to talk to you about later, but I feel like journalism has been kind of eaten alive by influencers. And these influencers are often very credulous. They're very happy to be near people who are powerful. And that, to me, is not the model of, you know, I'm not saying journalists should be sociopaths exactly, but you certainly shouldn't be in it in order to have a kind of nice life and hang out and for people to like you, I think, is a really big problem.
Yeah, yeah. So there are certainly several podcasters of late who've interviewed very prominent people, starting with the current president. And I see all the scars there of people imagining that if you simply maintain a good feeling during the conversation, you have done your work as a host, even given this rare opportunity to interview the incoming president of the United States. And therefore, they don't ask a single skeptical question. Yeah, it seems to me that the norms of journalism somehow have to be plowed into the most influential influencer venues, I mean, podcasts and, you know, other contexts. I don't know how that happens apart from just complaining about it.
Well, we'll try. Yeah, let's try that one. I've been trying that one for some time. It hasn't worked yet, but it might do.
How would you describe the difference between U.S. and U.K. journalism at this point? And maybe it's journalism and political culture. I mean, how would you? What could one side learn from the other, which are you more worried about? Which is showing the signs of erosion of our ability to make sense of the current moment more?
Oh, I mean, I think my work in America is definitely helped by having one foot still in Britain. And I know it's very easy to be jingoistic and assume that your country is sort of doing everything right because it's what you grew up with. But just think about our last election here we had last year, in which we went from a, you know, conservative majority government. We'd had conservatives in power for 14 years to a big swing to the Labour Party. But, you know, absolutely nobody called that as being, you know, the most important election of our lifetimes. It's an existential election on which democracy depends. If the other side get in, you know, either it's communism or it's fascism. Where are those things that I heard when I traveled around Pennsylvania in October? You know, once I genuinely thought that Kamala Harris, I would talk to people who genuinely thought Kamala Harris was a communist or a Marxist or whatever it might be. And I would talk to people who thought Trump is bringing in fascism. And when that's your opinion of the other side, it's very hard to see why anyone would vote for that person or why you might ever switch your party allegiance. And so you get into the same situation that you have with the problems of party corruption in much more religiously sectarian societies, right? Where if you never, you know, if your family's Protestant and you always vote for the Protestant party and there's nothing on earth that could make you vote for the Catholic party, that is not an invitation to the Protestant party to behave really well. You know, they know that they've got a certain level of block votes. And I think something similar feels very true to me about US politics is if the number of swing voters is so small, that is fundamentally very unhealthy for the parties.
I mean, do you think that the nature of the candidates justified that level of hyperpartisanship this time around? Or are the differences as stark in the UK and that just the response culturally around them is not as hysterical?
I don't think there's any world in which you can say that Kamala Harris or indeed Joe Biden are communists, right? Which was literally in some cases the accusations, or even Marxists. And I think that's just from people who use those as a kind of boo word for very left wing. What I think they actually meant by that is, you know, what you might call quote unquote wokeness. They meant that they were identity progressives.
Yeah.
They didn't really think that they wanted to, you know, expropriate the means of production and put everybody to work on collective farms. But, you know, I do think that the media in America is more extreme. The politics is more extreme, more polarized. And I don't have a particularly good explanation for why that is, apart from one of the things I'm guessing is happening is people are sorting themselves out into, you know, into communities that are less mixed than they once were. And I think particularly in terms of the media, so the BBC is our state-funded broadcaster. Everyone has to pay their license fee of £160 a year. But what you do there is you have political programs that have a duty to be impartial, a duty to present both sides. You know, I've sat on Question Time panels with people who are on completely different places from the political spectrum to me, and I have to listen to them and their opinions are given equal weight. And you don't really get that in American media. You know, I would watch CNN a lot during the election and they would have, you know, Scott Jennings, who's their kind of Republican, vastly outnumbered, and everyone would scream when he said something. And then you'd watch Fox News and then maybe occasionally they sort of let a liberal creep through the door, but then they'd say something and would immediately kind of get screamed down. And so you just don't have that tradition of listening to, of being forced to listen to the other side. And then social media obviously allows you to opt out completely of listening to the other side. My boss at The Atlantic, Jeff, did an interview with Obama a couple of years ago in which he said he watched the change happen even during his runs for president. He said he used to go to a little town in a swing state and there'd be a guy with a bow tie who edited the local newspaper, right? And maybe he was a Republican, but he knew that he had a district that had all kinds of different people in it and he'd give you a fair shake. And those people got, you know, those local papers have just been obliterated, replaced by very opinionated talk radio and now very opinionated conservatives. And so the number of places in the media that see their duty as talking to a wide spectrum of people has really dwindled.
And that hasn't happened in the UK to the same degree?
It hasn't happened to the same degree. It's definitely happened. We've had in the last couple of years the launch of two very, I mean, technically under broadcasting regulations, neutral, but in practice, right-wing TV channels. One of them folded. It ended up just as Piers Morgan's YouTube show, and then he kind of left. And then one GB News has become a kind of Fox News of Britain, really. Its viewership is relatively low, but it's definitely had an effect on British politics. I mean, you must notice sometimes where you see these memes kind of creep through, and it's like everybody's been issued a kind of order, like there's some event that everybody now cares about, or something that you say that just gets thrown at you and you just can't quite work out where it's come from. Like it's like overnight, everybody has sort of heard the same phrase or the same argument. And quite often I find that those come from those very partisan media sources. And there is an almost kind of like droid-like way that suddenly they kind of crest and they go into the public consciousness and then they move on and everyone's talking about someone else. And it's very hard if you're outside of them to kind of get an insight into how those things are happening and to understand why everybody's talking about this. And because of the BBC, there is still a sense in Britain that you do, you know, you are more likely to hear what the other side are talking about rather than these memes arise that you just, you know, like a sort of invasion of the body snatcher. Suddenly everyone is talking about something you've never heard of before, like it's always been there and it's the most important thing in politics.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are phrases where you have almost a whole orientation toward not just politics, but information online crystallized in a phrase. I mean, if someone uses the phrase Russiagate hoax without scare quotes around it, I think I know everything about their political worldview at this point, right? I mean, it's just, it condenses so much and it has been reiterated with such slavish loyalty now for years.
Right. When I'm writing about youth gender medicine, for example, there's a couple of ones that come up recently. So, and you heard them in the congressional hearings on girls' sport. The idea that actually what Republicans want are genital inspections. You know, right. And people just go, of course, what the right want are genital inspections. And you go, well, actually, the way that they sex test in sport is through a cheek swab and then through a blood sample, right? This was, genital inspections used to happen in the 60s, but then a lot of bad stuff used to happen in the 60s. That's not what actually we are asking for now. But I presume they've had a briefing from some charity or governmental lobby group or whatever it might be, or there has been something that's been in, you know, some very prominent influencer in their social media feeds has been putting this in. And then suddenly everyone kind of goes, of course, what the right really wants are genital inspections. Mm. And there's a question for me as a journalist is always about how much time do you spend rebutting stuff versus how much you spend actively trying to make the points that you want to make. And I think I still don't know where the balance is for that, because actually there is still a merit in somewhere like The Atlantic writing stuff down. And if it's not true, saying that it's not true. But you also do get this feeling that you're spending an enormous amount of time chasing phantoms.
Yeah.
And actually, is it stopping you from doing the good work that you would otherwise be doing?
Yeah, I mean, there is also a perverse psychological effect where merely discussing something in order to debunk it kind of ramifies it in people's memory as being true. It's called the illusory truth effect. I don't know. It could be one of these things that will not replicate when further studied. But there's just this asymmetry in information warfare, which is if you can force people to keep talking about something, you're doing the damage even if they're spending all the time debunking that something. And these are many topics we will, however regrettably, cover here. Before we do, is there anything that you in your daily life as a journalist are just refusing to touch because of the hassle or perceived hassle of touching that topic? I mean, for me, it has always been, I noticed you got here way before me, but for some period of time, I was avoiding the transgender activist debate just because I saw other people dealing with it, and it just seemed like it was more trouble than it's worth, right? I mean, it really had this outsized negative impact on everyone's life who touched it. You know, I just saw what happened to Jesse Singel, and I'm sure there are many people who are in his orbit who shared some of that pain. J.K. Rowling, obviously. Is there anything like that that is still out there that you are just inclined to ignore, though it's a real issue that could be talked about in good faith?
I think there are issues that I don't think about it exactly like that. I don't mind sticking my fingers in the plug socket, mostly because I kind of feel like if you don't, someone else always will, right? This is the kind of the idea that there is any way that the media can gatekeep what people talk about. You know, if the media doesn't talk about illegal immigration, then no one will think it's a problem. You know, that has just obviously turned out to be, you know, that's been very demonstrably proved to be not true.
Yeah.
I take a different approach, which is, I think this is probably how you maybe felt more about the transgender issue, which is there are some issues on which I don't necessarily have the expertise to add a lot. I don't think my voice necessarily is the one that's needed.
There's that, and also, you know, just that there is a perceived sense that just personally, it's just the hassle factor is too high. I mean, I distilled this once myself, you know, in a piece of advice that I never wound up taking, which is not everything worth saying is worth saying oneself, right? I mean, there's enough of a hassle associated with certain views, however valid they might be, that you just spend way too much time cleaning up the mess that everyone is eager to make on your behalf, right? People are going to willfully misunderstand what you said, even if it was only, you know, for 2 minutes on a podcast, and you could spend the next year of your life having that be the first question you're ever asked in every context. And it just was, in hindsight, it just wasn't worth it because either the point wasn't important enough, the topic wasn't important enough, or it's just so easily misunderstood that, you know, albeit important, it's, you know, you've got better things to do.
I do feel like that about Israel and Palestine. You know, I'm not a foreign policy expert by any means, and I have, you know, my own views on it. But I think that what happens with that debate is you get sucked into having to say every bad thing that has happened on every other side dating back almost to the Middle Ages, right? You need to kind of say, yeah, of course, we need to see this in the context of the displacement of the Palestinian people. Of course, we need to see this in the context of the Holocaust. Of course, we need to see this in the context of October the 7th. Of course, we need to see this. And I think you can end up being just derailed out of being able to say absolutely anything, to the extent that I think that that's the closest I think I come to the mere hassle idea. The other one, is probably IQ. So I've been writing this book about genius, which is out in the summer. Mm-hmm. And I've gone a little bit through the history of IQ. And I went and obviously I read, you know, lots of the debates about the hereditarians versus the environmentalists. And I, you know, and I asked two friends of mine with very different views on the subject who would to see whether or not they would both read those chapters. But I've taken a policy decision with that, that if I'm asked about that in interviews and off the cuff, I'm going to say, I'm sorry, you're going to have to read the book. I just think that is a subject on which it is absolutely not worth taking an idea for a walk in right. a kind of casual way, right? You know, and I don't think that's necessarily such a bad thing. There are subjects for which discussing them in a debate format or in a podcast format absolutely works. And there are others where actually just, you know, I think I more and more appreciate that feeling of just having time to sit down something, say, do I really think this? Can I absolutely sure I support this? Have I got all the footnotes ready? And that being an okay way to approach some subject. I'm not sure. Tell me, do you think, I mean, is that cowardly or is that responsible? I don't know.
Well, I do think you have to pick your battles. I mean, you only have so much time. So it is a bit of a triage question with anything you do, right? I mean, and insofar as you can foresee the outcome, I mean, often you can't, right? So you don't know how much having touched a topic is going to eclipse every other thing in your life for a period of time and prove to be a massive opportunity cost. So I recognize most of those things in hindsight.
I know what you mean, though. I went through a phase, you know, I interviewed Jordan Peterson for GQ back
right,
in 2018.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I went through a phase where every time I did an interview on any kind of podcast, someone would ask me about it. And it was obvious what was happening, which was that everybody wanted their little slice of the controversy pie, right? They wanted to get me saying something about Jordan Peterson that they could put it on YouTube where his name was, you know, instant karma. And I just thought, this is going to make me look like some weird monomaniac who's just going around the internet talking about something that happened to me now years ago.
Yeah.
But you also feel that you can't be, you know, it's impolite to say, I actually don't want to talk about this, like your kind of share, you know, in your 19th interview of the day. So I think that happens too.
Yeah, I had a similar thing with Ben Affleck. I think that took about a year for that not to be the first thing that I had to talk about in every context. And it's, I feel your pain. Although I'm probably going to ask you about Jordan Peterson in about 5 minutes. So let's start with the internet. This has to be the layer at which much of this mad work is being accomplished on our brains. What is the internet doing to us, in your view?
The thing I keep thinking about is the fact that we used to live in geographic communities. And they were, you know, people obviously sort themselves into people who live like them. You know, if you are rich, you can go and make sure that you only live near other rich people. Lots of people end up living soft lives of racial segregation by the places where they choose to live. You know, that is all possible. But nonetheless, your neighbors were much more likely to be varied in age and political temperament and actually just personality terms, right? You have this kind of just mixture of people around you. But what the internet has done, as far as I can see, you know, and I'm somebody who's been online since I was a teenager, is it's allowed people to sort themselves by interest. And that's had just some incredibly weird effects on us, I think. You know, we've ended up over-indexing on people who are very like us in particular ways. And you see some very unhealthy communities. I don't think it'd be so easy to form in real life. Mm. So my friend Hadley Freeman, for example, she wrote a brilliant memoir about being anorexic. And she talked about how unhealthy being on a hospital anorexia ward was for her. Because it was full of anorexic women competing with each other to who could eat the least and who could weigh the less, you know. And that's really, those things are really unhealthy, but that's quite a specific environment. But if you go onto the internet, you can find pro-Anna forums, you can find very unhealthy situations for teenage girls to be in, you know, who we know are really prone to social contagion, and they are just absolutely everywhere. You know, you want to find somebody to get into competition with about your dissociative identity disorder or your, you know, your alts or whatever it might be. Like that's just something that you know, is just lying in the middle of the road for you to pick up. And I think those things, you know, and you see it now. I think that what's happened with Twitter is a really fascinating example of this, which is that it's gone in the space of 2 years from an unrepresentative left-wing echo chamber to unrepresentative right-wing echo chamber. Mm. And people have just aggressively sorted themselves into the place that they want to be with only people who are very much like them. You know, I've just finished writing a piece about Ayella, who does these kind of massive sex work research surveys and people's fetishes. And even things like that, even at the level of human sexuality, people have now got ideas about things that they could do that they probably never would have met someone in normal life in the 1990s who was into that thing. And I think I just don't, we don't really have a way of kind of conceptualizing that. We don't really have a way of talking about that. But if the way that people organize themselves has just become narrowed in these ways, never mind the fact that now we're interacting with these things one-on-one, it's just you and this, you know, black screen that you stare at for hours and hours a day. All of that is really changing. You know, I think I've been writing a bit about young men and their, you know, their approach to the presidential election. And it really just struck me how ready-made the kind of whole lifestyle from those podcasts is. You know, you have your Zin pouches, you have your protein powders, you have your crypto, the ice baths, you have your day trading, you know, your gambling. And it's like a whole prepackaged consumer lifestyle that you kind of buy off the shelf. But it's kind of sands a lot of the rough edges off. And I, when I see people kind of complaining about, you know, online dating and stuff like that, a lot of the, you know, the complaints seem to be about it feeling so much like a marketplace, but then everything online feels like a marketplace or a slot machine. And you just don't get these kind of baggy, messy human interactions in the way that, you know, I think if you had to live in a small village somewhere, even though you'd be seeing only a very limited number of people, they'd all be sort of weird in different ways rather than you finding all the people who are weird in the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a very interesting insight. I mean, there's something about the internet that also filters the social idiosyncrasies and pathologies that would disqualify a person as a source of information, too. I remember seeing this in a family member now almost 25 years ago with the 9/11 truth conspiracy theory stuff. So this is like an early internet phenomenon, at least in my world, where I saw someone go down the rabbit hole with 9/11 trutherism. And one thing was clear is that if he had had to go to a conference, a physical conference out in the real world and meet the people who were similarly obsessed with this idea that 9/11 was an inside job and that all those voicemail messages from the doomed passengers on Flight 93, those were faked by CIA voice faking technology, and those people, that plane landed and those people were brought off and murdered and et cetera, et cetera. It gets as crazy as you want it to get. If he had gone to a conference and met the people who were manufacturing these ideas, in many cases, he would be able to see at a glance the dysfunction in their lives, the fact that this was, you know, that their attitude toward what was passing as journalism for them was born of, you know, psychological and social pathologies in many cases that were quite stark, right? And what you get with the internet is a web page or a, you know, now a feed on X, which is exactly as the person wants it to be. I mean, some of them are shrieking psychopathology, you know, despite the best efforts of the person involved, but still, you can't tell that this the person who made, to go back to 9/11, the documentary Loose Change that deranged the brains of a generation on that topic was, I think, at the time, you know, 18 years old and living in his mother's basement, right? Like what you saw was the product online, and it was radicalizing because it was just a pure information vector of ideological contamination. And yeah, now we're living in a context where if you want to stay on the anorexia ward, surrounded by the most persuasive anorexics on planet Earth, you can stay there forever now on the internet. Whereas in the real world, that kind of thing would have a natural half-life.
Right. And that's what Hadley writes about the thing that finally sort of snapped her out of it was watching somebody who was 32 having a tantrum because they put butter on her toast. And she thought, you know, she was then in her teens, do I really want to be 32? And my entire world, the scope of it, the largest thing that's happening in my life is whether or not they put butter on my toast. No, I want to go to university. I want to live. I want to have kids. I want to have a life.
Yeah.
And I think that that mechanism, that really important mechanism of there is something bigger than this, has been slightly broken by the internet, because there doesn't have to be anything bigger than this. You can sit home and get DoorDash and you know, and game and crypto day trade, and you can just have, you know, and that's the world is set up for you to do that.
Okay, so let's talk about the two sides of our politics. I mean, I hesitate to put too much stock in the notion of left and right at the moment, because they're, you know, we have horseshoe theory and other variables now that make it a less than useful schema, but something like that is my way into this. I mean, there's kind of the failing liberal order, right, where we have this loss of trust in institutions, in many cases for obvious reasons. Some of those reasons are exaggerated, but, you know, I share, you know, many right-of-center concerns around DEI and trans activism we mentioned. I worry about how we reboot in the U.S. context, how we reboot the Democratic Party into a sane platform for politics and an antidote to the populism we're seeing on the right. Let's take the nominally left side of this before we talk about the right. How do you view the loss of trust in mainstream journalism and other institutions? And what do you think we can do to regain that trust?
I really worry about it because I know what you mean. The difficulty in talking about it is about keeping the correct sense of proportion between the errors. You know, and I've written a lot about errors in journalism. There are some. But it's the same procedure as with science, is that what really matters is not the idea that you're never going to get anything wrong. What matters is what you do when you get it wrong and what the correction mechanism is. And journalism does have a correction mechanism. It should do. The idea of a free and diverse press is that everybody scrutinizes each other. And yes, you won't get a complete picture of reality from the New York Times or the Atlantic or Fox News. But if you have all of them in the same environment, then you are hopefully, if you want to, getting somewhere closer to a kind of complete picture of the truth. And so, it worries me that people don't seem to care about that. Mm. And I do wonder how much of that is about a feeling of just the fact that the world is very overwhelming and people want a kind of simple narrative. You know, conspiracy theories are very simple usually, right? There's a bad guy who did it or a load of bad guys in a room who did it. And it's very obvious and the solutions are very obvious. And that's what strongman politics is. So I think I see some of those things as being a reaction to what people feel is just overwhelming complexity in the world. But from my point of view, all of us are only kind of stonemasons who can only build our own little houses one by one, right? I don't think it's possible to fix everything at once. What I can do is kind of keep going out and doing the work that I think is important. And I suppose, that doesn't feel very meaningful, but this is, I don't, tell me whether or not this is unbearably bleak or if it is in fact actually quite hopeful at the end of the day. Which is that I just think that we're also an incredibly complacent society. And I think that's true of both Europe and America. I'm primarily talking about, professional middle class people. When Louis Pasteur invented pasteurization, people were absolutely delighted. When they got the smallpox vaccine, people were absolutely delighted. The measles vaccine, they were absolutely delighted because they knew what the alternative was like.
Yeah.
At the end of the Second World War, when we built all of these liberal institutions, people knew what it was like to experience a world war, to experience the idea that your son wouldn't come home or that your entire family was murdered. And I think we've just been coasting for a really long time on things getting a little bit worse, but for most people, still extremely tolerable. And so I think when I talk to people, and this is true on both sides of the political aisle, there is a kind of great deal of complacency about how bad the world can get and how bad it still is in lots of places. Something I think about a lot is the fact that Michael Lewis wrote, I think in The Fifth Risk, about these awards they had for civil servants, who'd done really great bureaucratic things, or they'd come up with great initiatives. And he found that a hugely disproportionate number of them were from first, I think, and second generation immigrants. So if you've come to the US from Somalia, then you are not complacent about the fact that it's nice to have drinking water and not to have a militia come around in the middle of the night. And I wonder if some of that, this is what I cling to as Trump passes ever more kind of crazy executive orders, is that when things do get bad, that's the necessary mechanism for people to react against it. And what has happened at the moment is that people have had things a little bit bad, but not actually that bad. And therefore when I talk to people, I talked to a young woman who was really interesting in Pennsylvania. And I asked her about, she was a Trump supporter, and I asked her about January the 6th. And she said, if he didn't respect democracy, why is he running for president? And I thought that was a really great and insightful thing to say, because from her point of view, there was nothing that I could say that would, that would counteract that. He was paying deference to the electoral system by participating in it. And I thought, we're right. She believes that if he was a maniac, the Republican Party would have stopped him. And the Republican Party didn't stop him. And that's the failure there. But it's not, she doesn't have a bad understanding of politics. It's just that politics has let her down in some profound way.
Yeah, I think complacency is part of it. Although when you look at the real, the extremity of the problem, I don't know that the complacency covers the nature of the error. I mean, so like I wouldn't think of the January 6th rioters as especially complacent, right? I mean, they actually, many of them traveled halfway across the country to attack the Capitol. And so it is with, people who go all in on, anti-vax, religiosity, essentially, right? I mean, they're completely subsumed by this concern. And they're spending a tremendous amount of time trying to find, you know, all of the nefarious clues online that reveal, you know, how dangerous vaccines are or how corrupt the pharmaceutical industry is. Or, you know, they've listened to scores of hours of RFK Jr. Spread his misinformation and half-truths and, you know, genuine lies in some cases. So there's a massive, in many cases, there's a massive investment of time and even resources in becoming kind of actively misled, but, you know, or what we would consider misled based on having a sense of what, you know, the ground truth reality is on any one of these topics. I mean, no, Donald Trump did not win the 2020 election. It was not stolen from him. And, you know, all of your QAnon inflected ratiocination on that topic is in fact a waste of time. The problem, I think, is that whenever you find a kernel of truth to any of these conspiracy theories, right? I mean, the real, you know, background incidents of vaccine injury or the actual case where DEI has led to some horrifically bad outcome. I mean, to take this recent plane crash in Washington, in D.C., you know, Trump's first allegation is that, you know, DEI explains this plane crash, whether it was on the FAA side or the, you know, the military helicopter side or both. It seemed an utterly grotesque and, you know, borderline psychopathic thing to say in the moment when your job is really to, you know, restore people's sense of normalcy and assure them that you're going to get to the bottom of the problem. And it was obviously, it was before any of the facts were in, so he couldn't possibly know if DEI was the real reason for it. You certainly couldn't know that at that point. But if, in fact, it proves to be true that the FAA had some, as is now rumored at the time we're discussing this, the FAA had some aggressively and, in hindsight, probably patently insane DEI program that was selecting not for competence but for skin color for some considerable period of time, that will seem to confirm everyone's worst fears about everything on that topic, right? I mean, so it's again, this comes back to something like asymmetrical information warfare, whereas when you can find the half-truth or the single conspiracy that is in fact true, then that gives people more or less carte blanche to believe anything on insufficient evidence as long as it's to their taste in that vein, you know, for years to come. And you have to do so much extra work to debunk any of that misinformation, because what's always lingering, we have this with the Wuhan Institute of Virology lab leak issue now, right? I mean, because that was stigmatized as a racist conspiracy theory within 15 minutes by the left, and now it is proved an all too plausible thesis, although albeit one for which the jury is still out. Now the New York Times is no better than Fox News, or even, you know, paradoxically worse, et cetera, et cetera. And you're now dealing with people who won't believe anything that the normal gatekeepers say, whether it's the government or media.
There's an awful lot of Mott and Bailey, though, isn't there? And that's, you know, that term for the argumentation strategy where you go out on a limb and say something really crazy and then, if challenged to it, you know, withdraw back to your castle. And, you know, some of the claim about that was that COVID was a bioweapon developed in a lab, right? And that's not what anybody who's now saying, well, look, we don't know what was happening. So that, you know, that's, and I think the same thing is possibly true with the case of the air crash, in that Tracing Woodgrains, who used to be a reporter on Blockchain Reported, did some really interesting reporting on the FAA under Obama changing the regulations. But what that's turned into is the fact that, you know, the relatives of the female pilot who died were afraid to have her name released because they thought she'd be, you know, torn apart as a kind of tokenistic hire. But people will kind of just throw this sort of chaff up into the air, and then if any tiny bit of it is true, they claim victory. And I think that's the bit where I really struggle, because it does make you feel very, you know, like the kind of ground shaking beneath your feet, in that, you know, that you can point out the facts all you want, but the vibe is just so much stronger. I had a friend who described the point of journalism as the war of facts against narrative. And I think that is the big challenge now today for journalism, is saying, yes, there might have been this going on, but it's actually a little bit more complicated than that. And that bit of that you believe isn't true. Whereas what people want it to be is, you know, yeah, was it a Chinese plot? Yes or no? And you kind of go, well, actually, it's a bit more complicated than that. You know, was it DEI? Yes or no? Well, actually, yes, you know, it might be a bit more complicated than that. And no one really kind of wants that. And I think it leads to a lot of faulty thinking because people just apply that heuristic, don't they? They just apply the frame that they want, that they are now used to thinking of everything through to every new situation. Sometimes that frame is right, but as a shortcut, inevitably, sometimes it's wrong.
What do you think the sanest way is to thread the needle on DEI and trans activism and intersectionality and all of these other ways of framing or misframing our obviously well-intentioned concern about civil rights and political equality? Maybe I'm asking you not so much to put your journalistic hat on here, but the just your ethical, political one. I mean, what is the right answer here, do you think?
The one thing I have some sympathy with the criticisms that you've made of DEI, but one of the things I find in some of the most active DEI critics is that they are, I wish they had a little bit more sympathy about what led to DEI, if that makes sense. And if you think it's really terrible to discriminate against white people, then you should also take into account that the fact that the history of the United States has an extensive history of legal discrimination against black people, right? Which is what the civil rights movement arose in opposition to, which is what the subsequent movements arose in opposition to. And so, yeah, I think we should talk more about equality of opportunity, realistically. That's the bit that works for the left, that people intuitively understand the idea of fairness, right? They understand the idea that if you're a really well-qualified woman, you shouldn't walk in the door and people go, oh, we all know that women can't be pilots, she'll be rubbish, right? That they would actually genuinely take a really fair look at you. The bit where I think that people really revolt against is actually affirmative action and quotas. And I think I probably, in the last 10 years of thinking about this, toughened up my feeling that they just are not worth it. In the same way that I think, you know, there was a big discussion about reparations. And that was a big left-wing cause for a time. And I remember reading a piece that said, I thought this was a very compelling argument, which said, if you do universal welfare programs that are apply to everybody in poverty, in America, you will end up helping a lot more people who are black, because a lot more people who are black are living in poverty. But what you will never say is, here is my grant that is going to help one particular racial group of people, which will make everybody else feel like, you know, what am I, chopped liver? And I think that the left has just got to be smarter about the way that it talks about that stuff, because yeah, for a long time, you know, people weren't allowed to be openly gay in the military. It is good that we've ended that as a prohibition. You know, it is good that women are now allowed to go to university. These things are, you know, equality of opportunity has been a really brilliant, you know, I think a real success for the left that it should be really proud of. We are now harnessing more of the talent that was latent in the population that people weren't getting a chance to exercise than they were before. But the bit that people don't like is the sense of a kind of government-mandated fiat from the top down. And I think that's the bit where, and I wonder if that's due to a lack of confidence on the left, right? The idea, I think trans activism being a very obvious example, a feeling that people won't really like this if we explain this to them. So why don't we just push it through? I think Yasha Monk calls it the short march through the institutions. You know, let's push it through. Let's get every corporate HR department to sign up to this. And then we'll present it as a fait accompli, and then everyone will, you know, accept it and job done. And I think that, you know, the polling is really stark to me. So if you look at the polling in Britain on something like gay marriage or whether or not gay relationships are wrong, in the 90s, I'm being vague with my figures here, but I think, you know, a majority of people would have said that gay relationships are sometimes or always wrong. And that has completely flipped. Because what's happened is everybody's kind of met very normie gays and gone, oh, right, okay, they're very boring. They're just like heterosexuals. And they're not kind of weird and scary and here to demolish the nuclear family. You do not see that at all on some of the radical gender activism. Actually, if you track the polling over the last 5 years, as people have heard about it, they have liked it less and less. You know, something like, you know, biological males competing in women's sports, for example. Just as soon as people had that explained to them, they went, oh, no, that sounds really unfair. We're not up for that. And so I think it does speak to a lack of confidence on the left to be able to make and win those arguments. But making and winning those arguments is the only way you really embed that change. And that's what, you know, the left in its best manifestations, whether it is the suffragettes, whether it's the civil rights movement, you know, those people went out and they fought and they fought and they made the case. You know, often they had to make the case for their own humanity first. It wasn't easy for them, but they did it and they changed people's minds. And I think that there has been a sort of shortcut of, oh, if only we could just find our like little cheat code to get around doing this. And I think that has been the problem. And I think we've got to get back to that sense of, here's what I believe in. Like, let me, you know, hear me out. And I think I can convince you.
Well, one of the things that's so interesting about the trans activist debate is that the argument in many respects is unwinnable, right? I mean, it's not a unitary phenomenon in the first place. When you talk about gender identity issues, the phenomenon of teenage girls having gender dysphoria is just, it's obviously functioning by different dynamics than the phenomenon of young boys, you know, biological males having gender dysphoria, which is to say there's an impressive evidence of social contagion in the former. I'm not aware of any in the latter. And so to even talk about it as a unitary phenomenon is somewhat misleading. But the other interesting thing is that there are clear trade-offs between championing the rights of transgender people and championing those of gays and women, right? So it's in tension with feminism and gay rights in ways that very few people anticipated. And I mean, the competitive sports is one, but I mean, it's just the very weird conceptual tug of war, which is from the trans point of view, biological sex, your actual gametes at birth is just fundamentally not important, right? I mean, you can, your gender is a layer on top of that, which you're completely free to change. Whereas from a gay rights point of view, biological sex is the only thing that makes being gay intelligible, right? I mean, if you're a gay man who's attracted to other men, you are defining that attraction in terms of your biological sex. And you have these, you know, perverse allegations. I mean, my friend Andrew Sullivan has spoken about this at some length, but you have it said of gay men, if they're not equally attracted to trans men, they're transphobic, right? And that's, so there's these weird, you know, zero-sum trade-offs.
Yeah, I think that's the movement really ran into trouble at that point because, you know, gay men just went, what? No.
Yeah.
Whereas I think they had a little bit more success in bullying lesbians. And, you know, that, which again was one of the things I wrote about this in my book, Difficult Women, that we have a long history of women being told they don't really have a sexuality, or lesbians being told they just need to find the right man. You know, that was the kind of sexist bore thing that got said when I was, you know, when I was growing up, was that lesbians just, you know, they just needed some dick and then they'd kind of, and then they'd sort themselves out. And so then to kind of, I think this is why in Britain, at least, you know, lesbian feminists often led the charge on some of this stuff, is that this was, you know, this was stuff that they had heard coming out of the mouths of pub room bores of their dad's generations, was now coming out of the mouths of men in their own generation, but rebranded as progressive. But, you know, I think that one's going to be a really difficult one because I looked at all those Trump executive orders and there are things in them that I agree with, undoubtedly. I might not agree with the way it's been done. I think it would have been much, you know, I think executive orders generally seem to be a very bad way of governing. Mm. But I also think that there is a kind of gleefulness and an othering in them that is really unpleasant. Yeah. And a sense of saying that some people are freaks and degenerates that I just do not go along with. And I think, you know, you and I are in this interesting position where we piss off people on both sides. And so people kind of go, why are you talking about this set of people? Why aren't you talking about this set of people? And the answer is that I will talk about whichever set of people I feel have the most cultural power at that time, right? Like I'm here to be oppositional to people who I think are being unscrutinized in the level of power that they have. And so I fully expect to spend the next 4 years writing about all of the Trump overreaches, having spent a lot of the last 4 years writing about the left's overreach. You know, it's just the thing that I'm against is overreach. But I feel like, I don't know if you feel this, I feel just lonelier and lonelier doing that, really.
Yeah, well, it's where all the interesting conversations are, but it's amazing how few allies you can seem to have when if you're not aligned with one side of the cultural tribe versus the other. Yeah, it's got to be easier to just be on the right or just be on the left and always firing in the same direction. Well, the phrase freaks and degenerates is still ringing in my ears, and I think we're going to build a bridge to them in a moment because I want to talk about the Rotherham scandal. But let's linger on the point of feminism for a second. So what is the state of feminism, in your view, in under the shadow of all of this conversation around trans rights and the fluidity of gender? How does one articulate feminism now in a way that doesn't just pitch you into a maybe it's unavoidable, but I'm just picturing the X feed of J.K. Rowling as the state of current feminism. How would you articulate feminism to a 20-year-old woman who wants to be a feminist at this moment?
I think, you know, I feel like, yeah, we had to take a big detour to just establish some, you know, basic concepts again. You know, one of the big challenges to me, and I should be open about the fact that I think this is something that I have changed on and I probably got wrong or got the emphasis on wrong before. A friend of mine said, do you think that, you know, all the kind of gender critical stuff has made feminists more, essentialists, more open to the idea that men and women are fundamentally different? And I thought about it for a long time, and I think that's right. I think that the wave of feminism that I grew up with when I was in my 20s really just wanted to wish away any kind of either biological or psychological differences between men and women on average. Mm-hmm. And I think that there has been a kind of a crawl back towards that. Now, I would still caveat that by saying, I think, obviously, biological differences are pretty cut and dried, right? We can talk about those. Psychological differences are much harder to kind of delineate because they're so affected by culture. You know, in the 1900s, people said women's brains were physically smaller and that meant that they couldn't go to university. You know, and now the problem is that, in fact, we're having trouble getting young men to go to university. So, you know, I think you have to be very humble about the fact that there are limits to what you can know about sex differences in the brain. But that is definitely something that I feel I'm okay now with saying that mostly because of testosterone, men are on average stronger and more violent and more prone to committing sexual crimes, right? These are things that actually in my 20s, it would have really been difficult for feminists to say. Mm. And I think as part of the kind of, you know, backlash to gender ideology or whatever you want to call it, feminists have become a lot more okay about saying those things. And that's the kind of stuff that I would say to young feminists now. I would say that, you know, you are probably more likely, all the statistics show that if you're in a heterosexual relationship, you will do more unpaid labor around the home. Your career will take a hit when you have kids. That happens to almost every mother. Whereas, you know, your partner will be told what a great daddy is and, you know, and might get promotions on the basis of being now like a settled, stable kind of guy. You know, that you do have to be on the lookout for domestic violence, which is still incredibly widespread. Things like that are just, you know, are just part of the female experience. Women's health problems are still underdiagnosed, under researched. You know, the things that we don't know about menopause would, you know, vastly outweigh the things that we do, for example. My friend Carolyn Criado-Perez wrote a book called Invisible Women, which is about the fact that, you know, women aren't included often in drug trials because they'll say, well, we just really worry about, you know, what if you're pregnant or whatever it might be. And so you end up often with drugs that are primarily used in women not being tested on female bodies. And all of that stuff is, you know, it's still there. It's still happened. There is still a point to feminism, but it doesn't have to necessarily kind of aspire to a kind of future in which men and women are exactly the same. And I think that's been the difficult thing, right? Because the great triumphs of feminism, like getting the vote, were about saying we want to be treated exactly the same. We want to be able to be president. We want to be able to be magistrates and we want to be able to vote. And then actually the new phase of feminism, which is saying that there are some ways in which we differ in important ways, and we want to be treated differently, but equally. That's, I think that's conceptually harder to defend and people have kind of struggled with.
Do you think treating people as individuals just rigorously across the board is a formula for bypassing all of these ethical and political conundrums? I mean, because obviously the differences between men and women are statistically valid, right? I mean, you mm-hmm. can generalize over the course of across a population and say that, you know, in the main, you know, men will be stronger. Certainly their upper bodies will be stronger than women. And they'll be more interested in things than in people when compared to women, et cetera, et cetera. So these are, you know, probabilistic judgments about individuals in a population selected at random. But when an individual actually walks through the door applying for a job or to get into a medical school or to do anything else, the burden is upon you, ethically and politically, to evaluate that person as an individual. And there, obviously, you can find women who are stronger than 90% of men, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is a kind of the libertarian, you know, centrist or in some cases, right of center, you know, magic formula. Why doesn't that solve all of our problems?
I think it solves your problems in hiring, certainly. It doesn't solve your problem with how do you set a federal or company parental leave policy. Because if we say you're going to have 3 months leave for everybody who has a baby, what we know is that men who don't have to, you know, who are not physically recovering from childbirth and maybe breastfeeding tend to use that, you know, time to, I know personally men who've used that time to like write a book or do a research paper, whatever it is, do a project, that isn't option isn't available to women who are devoting their bodily resources to sustaining the life of another human being. And that's when I think you can't treat people individually, because it just ends up with certain assumptions about who the default human is. So it doesn't always work.
I've thought about this for 4 seconds. I'm going to make up a policy and tell me what's wrong with this. So I think when you look at parental leave policies, I think many people want the mother to be able to stay home with the kid for a good long time, because that is, you know, clearly optimal for the kid, for the mother, for the family, for society, et cetera. So you want that. So let's call that 3 months or however long it takes, 6 months. And then to make this truly equal and cognizant of the different family arrangements people have. So you imagine two gay men who adopt a child, right? You need paternal leave that is equivalent to maternal leave. But in the vast majority of cases, that ignores the obvious difference between most moms and most dads, whereas most dads are not going to be in for the truly labor-intensive first few months or even first year or even years the way the mom is. But we can acknowledge that in a relationship between two gay men, one of them has to do it, very likely, right? So why not have a policy which is, again, focused on individual caregivers and individual parents, which acknowledges this difference. Who in the family is basically going to be the stay-home parent for a good long time, and who is going to keep working? And couldn't we just design a policy, a kind of an honest evaluation of that, rather than default saying it's only the mom if she's in fact a biological woman, or it's got to be both parents in order to be fair and to cover all the anomalous cases where it's, you know, two moms or two dads?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, and the case in Britain is if you do, you know, same-sex parents, you do get parental leave on that basis or adoption leave on that basis. There's also an interesting thing in the Scandinavian countries, I can't remember which one, I think Norway, where there is a portion that is for the father or same-sex partner that can, you know, that is paid by the government that can only be taken by him, right? Because they found out there was not a very high take-up of shared parental leave. But if they say, here's the portion that you can only take. And I think, you know, lots of dads would love to be at home a little bit longer with their kids too. As you say, maybe a bit later on in the baby's development. The problem comes, I think, with this, let's treat everyone as individuals, is that you end up with these isolated incidents and no way to kind of link together these things that are happening across the constellation of women's lives. There are a whole load of things that happen to women because they're women. And if it's just happening to random atomized individuals, and that's actually weirdly, you've kind of talked yourself there into the kind of trans activist point of view, which is you erase the word woman. And therefore, there are just some people with uteruses who need abortions. But what there are women who are the same people that might not get taken seriously at work because they're seen as having mum brain, or not get taken seriously in public debates because they're an old crone. You know, all of these things that are linked together that are across the life cycle of women that all have to do with their perceived or actual reproductive capacity aren't things that happen in isolation. They are, you're removing your ability to join the dots between lots of commonalities of experience. And I'm sure the same is true of experiences that happen to men as well. And that is my worry about the fact that if you take away the idea that you can actually put people into groups who all have very similar experiences, obviously when there are legal constraints and stuff, back in the days when you had redlining or Jim Crow, obviously people weren't being treated as individuals. You needed to be able to name those groups that were being disproportionately affected in order to fight effectively for them. And I still think there are softer versions of discrimination now, often not, you know, ones that are embedded in law, that you still need to be able to say this is happening because someone belongs to group X. So yeah, I think there are definitely situations in which you have to treat people as individuals, and that's definitely happening more. I think that's happening in hiring a lot more. And I think the DEI stuff that you're criticizing was about the idea that you lower the regulations for a certain type of person, right?
Yeah.
And I think that is the one that people get upset about. But, you know, it's quite widespread, and I don't think it's always a bad idea. So, for example, when I went to university, there was a different grade offer for people who had been to private schools versus people who had been to state schools. You had to get higher grades if you had been to a private school.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I think, a perfectly reasonable acknowledgement of the fact that your parents pay thousands and thousands of pounds in order to have you, like delicate flower that you are, coached through this. Whereas if you go to a state school, it might be you get one duff teacher. You know, you might have to be in a class with the most disruptive kid, who, whatever it might be, and that, you know, therefore, through no fault of your own, even as a brilliant student, you might drop a grade. You know, that is positive discrimination, but I think it was one that I think is entirely defensible, personally.
Mm. Yeah, that's a hard one. I mean, it really depends on the context, I think. I mean, there are cases where I think you want to be blind to all of these variables and just be looking for competence because it's just lives depend on it, right? I mean, if you're looking at airline pilots, I mean, honestly, I don't want to know anything about the person other than how good they were in the simulator before you let them in the plane, right? It's like, it seems perverse to care about anything else. And, you know, so it is with neurosurgeons or, you know, just when someone's going to go into your, you know, kid's brain with a scalpel, you don't want to be thinking that there was some DEI machinery that promoted this person past their, you know, their natural aptitude. And
sure,
now you have to,
now
you're
example,
a racist for thinking the thoughts that maybe they're not the best candidate to perform this one life-saving right. surgery on your kid or to fail to.
Yeah, sure. And I think that's entirely reasonable. But like for another thing that Oxford does, for example, is it does a foundation year, again, for people from marginalized backgrounds that gives, you know, that takes the opportunity of saying that they may have come from further behind, but then right. by the end, they still take the same exams as everybody else. So that's the version of it, I think, that in the case of whatever it might be, pilots, that's reasonable to say, if you come from a terrible inner city school where, you know, and you grew up in a household where no one speaks English, maybe you need to have a foundation year before you do this. But at the end, we're going to put you through the same exams as everyone else. And you only if you pass them. This is what I mean about equality of opportunity. I think that's the stuff that you can do without people feeling that standards have been lowered or that everybody who succeeds in that, who's from a woman or from a minority, has got this kind of mark on them that everyone will always assume that they were a token.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So now we're going to get to the perhaps the deepest part of the morass here. I want to talk about the Rotherham scandal. And this is a bridge to talking about the fever dream right of center that is kind of swirling around, you know, the MAGA cult and, you know, Elon's contributions to it, all the conspiracy thinking and just the algorithmic derangement of everything right of center. Once again, we have this problem of the kernel of truth or the half truth or even the wholly true scandal that is getting stumbled upon and amplified by, in this case, Elon, who has the world's biggest megaphone, and doing it in a way that is, you know, despite the fact that there's a true scandal here, there's no journalistic sensibility at all to how he's interacting with this information. And needless to say, he never corrects his errors and his fans don't care. What was the Rotherham scandal and how is it being treated now in the current conversation online?
I mean, I think this is a classic example of what you were talking about earlier about the ways in which certain subjects are not too much hassle to talk about, but very prone to misinterpretation. You know, I wrote a piece about this for The Atlantic. I talked about it on the Private Eye podcast. And in both cases, people who normally would be, I think, ideologically aligned with me, they said they were very disappointed in me, which is one of those great criticisms, like they're your mum, very disappointed in you. Because what I said was this, which is it is a real scandal. So beginning, the reports that we have date it from the 80s or 90s, that there were towns across Northern England and the Midlands in which young girls primarily were groomed, and this was not seen in those terms at the time. It was seen that there were some people who were engaged in what was then called child prostitution. But the classic dynamic of it would be that a young girl was a tearaway, or I think about a third of the girls in some of the cases were in care, and they would meet somebody, a handsome young guy, in most of the cases I'm talking about from an Asian background, from a British Pakistani background, who would act like their boyfriend, you know, buy them drugs, buy them alcohol, buy them cigarettes, and then introduce them to his friends. And in return for the continued supply of drugs and alcohol and cigarettes, or sometimes just through flat out coercion, they would essentially be pimped out to all of those people. Mm. And you have situations in which girls as young as 9 or 11 are ending up in situations like this, and people are trying to raise the alarm and no one listens to them. The girls themselves, when they rarely interact with police, which they obviously don't want to, are not believed. And the way that this scandal is talked about is often in terms of people not wanting to talk about it because of race and the idea that there is a kind of political correctness angle to it. Now, that was true in some of the reports that we have into it. You know, people really do talk about that there was an idea that we don't want to talk about this because of community tensions. But there were also some very old-fashioned misogynistic views that I think really held back for people from taking it seriously. Lots of the police, for example, didn't listen maybe to female social workers who brought this up, or the girls themselves, who they saw as little slappers, little tarts, you know, these girls, they're getting something out of it. You know, they're getting vodka. They've consented. And I think that's another big thing that has changed in the last 20 years is the idea of a 13-year-old who's being picked up from her care home by a 30-year-old struck some people as a kind of lifestyle choice. And now, hopefully, we see that more for it is, which is what it is, which is statutory rape.
Mm.
And so this was a genuine scandal. It's happened in at least a dozen towns that we know of. In the picture of overall group child sex exploitation, this is a grooming gangs, Asian grooming gangs, are a distinct phenomenon. So there were two cases in January of grooming gangs, both of which were white. There was a white one in Camborne and Cambridge in 2010. It is not exclusively an Asian problem, but we do know in some places that the fact that it was primarily British Pakistanis involved prevented people from feeling that they could speak up about it. So there is something legitimate there to be talked about. You know, it was also seized upon by the far right, which complicates the situation, because then a load of well-meaning people said, well, we mustn't talk about this because we'll have English Defence League marches down the street. And, you know, and all the government reviews, you read the review by Louise Casey into Rotherham, and she says this was entirely counterproductive. People thought this wouldn't, you know, this would sort of shut things up, but it just made it worse. And then there's a whole other load of stuff about the fact that these guys were often working in the minicab industry or running shisha bars. You know, they were stalwarts of the takeaways. You know, they were running in the nighttime economy.
Mm.
So I think it's useful to see it. I wrote this in my piece for The Atlantic, a bit like school shootings, which is it's a particular type of crime that comes out of a particular set of social circumstances. And race is a part of that. Class is a part of that. Misogyny is part of that, as is the kind of nighttime economy. And so the scandal of it really was broken by the London Times, owned by Rupert Murdoch, by a very brave reporter called Andrew Norfolk. And again, you read the reports and the councils involved say, oh no, we're being attacked by the Murdoch press. You know, they're just battering us. This is, this is terrible. And he specifically wrote about Rotherham to start with. And then this, so it kicks off this wave.
This was about 20 years ago, right? What wasn't the, didn't the story break?
Yeah, his first story was 2011.
Okay, 15 years
ago. Yeah, and the Times, under James Harding, who was a liberal editor, ran a series of front page stories on this.
Didn't Julie Bindle write something in the Times?
Julie Bindle tried to write about it in the 2000s, yes. And yeah. She says she was turned down by one paper.
Uh-huh.
She also wrote about the case of Charlene Downs, I believe, who was murdered in Blackpool and no one was ever convicted.
Mm-hmm.
And her body was never found. So it was, you know, there is a point to say that it was hard to write about. Julie was accused of being Islamophobic. Andrew Norfolk was accused of being Islamophobic, both of them for pointing out the racial dimensions of this. But from about 2014 onwards, you know, I went, when I wrote my piece and read all of the reports into this, you know, you have the leader of Oldham Council in 2014 being very overt about the fact that we are talking about people from a particular Asian community involved in this. It is in the first sentence of Louise Casey's report in 2015. So the bit that got to me from Elon Musk getting interested in it over Christmas was his belief that he was a kind of lone voice in the wilderness who's the only one who's prepared to say the unsayable.
Right.
And that is both a kind of very classic right-wing trope, right, that the media is lying to you. And he accompanied it with an awful lot of, this is why you don't hate the media enough. X is the only place you can get your news. But also a kind of narcissism, which is that because I've only just heard about this, so has everyone else.
Yeah.
Which I think social media also encourages. You see all this kind of sort of self, you know, participatory adventures where people do their own kind of true crime podcasts that they're making with them and their friends. I think that really got to me in a way I wasn't expecting, because I know people who've worked really hard to get those stories out. You know, somebody like Andrew Norfolk, who until he retired, thanks to ill health, you know, worked incredibly hard on those stories, never really, you know, self-glorifying himself about what he'd done or kind of making a big deal about it. It was just the work. And then this new era comes along in which, yeah, somebody strolls into it, hears about it for the first time, assumes that it must be they're the one who've broken open the scandal. And there was this incredible detail. Sorry, I'm ranting. Incredible detail in the Sunday Times at the weekend about one of the guy who posted some of the sentencing remarks, who goes by the pseudonym Max Tempers on X. He found these sentencing remarks from 2013 trial, posted them. They were picked up.
Mm-hmm.
So two things about him. One, he uses a pseudonym on Twitter because he's got a job in finance and he doesn't want to get in trouble for posting, shall we say, racially inflammatory content. And the other was that this was the first time that he had ever posted about these scandals. And this was to me was just the absolute paradigm of it. So you're getting somebody who has just wandered into this and suddenly the media are getting it in the neck for why haven't you covered this? And there was no real way of rebutting it, right? How do you rebut it when you say, actually, we did cover this, you didn't care. I'm sorry, you didn't read this. You weren't an informed citizen. And if you had been interested in violence against women, perhaps you might have heard about it earlier. But, you know, it was a runaway mind train of people being incredibly self-righteous. Some of them, like Julie, you know, who have suffered terrible consequences for lots of things she's written about, I think have every right to be annoyed about some of the liberal pieties on the subject. But some of it was, you know, men who don't even have the courage to put their name behind their spicy opinions, telling people like me that we're not brave enough. And that was the bit I found very symptomatic of what social media has done to these discussions.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, it's one of those cases where the half-truth is so disorienting, because what is true, the kernel of truth here, is that the fact that it was so hard to write about, the fact that it took years, the fact that you had the examples of parents hearing that their daughter was raped, coming into police stations and not being taken seriously, not just the daughters not being taken seriously, but parents not being able to find authorities who would do anything on their behalf, or you had labor MPs who made initial noises about it and then were shunned. The fact that all of that identitarian moral confusion was so consequential for years. And I think we're still talking about, these numbers sound impossible, but, it was some thousands or, well over 1,000 girls we're talking about being, in many cases, just, raped and gang raped. There are gradations to the phenomenon. There has to be something like a bell curve of more or less consent. But, on one extreme end of that curve, you've got, 12-year-olds being gang raped by Pakistani men who feel licensed to do it because they consider them subhuman. And you have a DEI woke apparatus at seemingly all levels of social work and government and journalism concealing this problem and prolonging it. And then you have, but this all began to be understood and talked about, as you pointed out, for, years ago, over a decade ago. I mean, I've mentioned it on my podcast several times over the last, 8 years or so. I mean, I've known about this scandal for a long time. Obviously, Douglas Murray has been whinging about this problem and adjacent problems for his entire career, virtually, as a public figure.
But I have to say that Douglas Murray has not been helpful in some ways, because one of the people that he's championed and that Elon Musk has championed is Toby Robinson, who's this convicted mortgage fraudster known as Stephen Yaxley Lennon. Now, he's kind of revered on parts of the hard right as being the guy who broke open the scandal, which is just, again, not in fact true. He's a guy who, in fact, poured a load of petrol over it and made a lot of people very reluctant to touch the subject.
Yeah.
And also, he went and filmed outside. There were a series of interlinked trials, and the way that it works in Britain is that, you have to, there are reporting restrictions on one trial so that the people in the next one get a fair hearing. The jury isn't prejudiced. Very different to America, where, the presumption is that you can report anything and the jury should just sequester themselves. So Tommy Robinson very nearly collapsed one of these trials. In fact, his signature move in all of this has been that he nearly made it, he made it harder for the justice system to send these guys down for a really long time, which is what they deserve.
Right.
And I think that's the complicated, I don't think anybody comes out of the grooming gang scandal particularly well, because I don't think anybody comes out of these horrific, really just absolutely incomprehensible acts of evil very well. We just don't know how to react to it. People instinctively think, as you say, the numbers are huge. 1,400 was the number in Rotherham, according to Alexis Jay's report. And then the follow-up report by Louise Casey said, people are really reluctant to believe it. They question the number, right? In the same way that they question anti-Semites question the number of Jews killed in the Holocaust. It was almost too disgusting. People just wanted to say, well, that can't possibly be true. And if you're lying about that, then you must be lying about everything else. And I think, it makes me think about, I don't know if you followed the Gisele Pellico trial last year. It is incomprehensible to me that a man found 50 men, 100 men within a small region of rural France who were willing to rape his unconscious wife and be filmed doing it. And I think these stories, one of the reasons you might say that the media doesn't cover them is people don't want to read about them, because it is staring into the pure heart of darkness. That the fact that, I think the way these work is often that there are people in the heart of them who are just purely evil and would always have been evil. And then they're surrounded by a penumbra of people who are weak and end up doing evil things because they have no resistance to a charismatic leader. And those things are just really people don't want to spend time thinking about them because they're too horrible.
But there's another ring in that penumbra, which is that the people who, based on their own sort of self-righteous moral confusion politically, hear about, are confronted with this evil and the cowardice that enables it, and they have precisely the wrong reaction to it, right? They have the opposite reaction. Rather than take the side of the little girl who has been gang raped, they, based on their, you know, left-wing shibboleths around political correctness and, you know, not don't be racist, don't be Islamophobic, they shut the whole thing down, even in many cases, while knowing what is true, you know, knowing the actual shape of the evil that has occurred in their society. The most egregious case, I can't even believe this is true, but it was reported at the time when you had this is just a symptomatic of how deep political correctness can run. There was the example of a woman during the exodus of Syrian refugees out of Syria and into Europe. There was a German woman who apparently was raped by immigrants, and she was so worried that that would stigmatize unfairly all of the refugees coming into her society that when she reported the rape, she said that they were, you know, native Germans who had raped her, right? And then she later, you know, recanted and confessed that these were immigrants, right? So if you just imagine, I mean, the level of masochism and delusion that enables such a thing, if in fact that story is true, there's a left-wing masochism that many of us worry about in society, which is, in the interest of not being racist, in the interest of not being Islamophobic, we will, in the case of a scandal like Rotherham, we will allow young women and girls to be gang raped for decades by the thousands and do nothing about it, right? So then into this morass wanders Elon Musk, albeit quite belatedly. And basically his point is, I'm bending over backwards to be charitable to somebody who's at this point, you know, a fairly psychopathic troll.
Yes.
But the charitable interpretation of his behavior is, I don't care who wrote a few articles in the Times about this a decade ago. This is diagnostic of everything that ails left-wing society, both in my country and in every other. The fact that this was possible is such a sanity-straining aberration that this should have been talked about 100 times more than it was. And I'm going to use my megaphone to talk about it right now. And anyone who's at all tainted with this thing, who's avoiding this thing in the UK, whose political career is dependent upon us not looking too closely at what they were doing 15 years ago in whatever position of responsibility they held, I'm going to rip the lid off all of this and talk about nothing else until I get distracted by the next shiny object that I'm going to whinge about. And the fact that I'm late to the party and not acknowledging the fine and courageous work that was done by a handful of journalists is irrelevant, because it should have never required courage, right? It should have just required moral sanity, and everyone should have been on this from the very beginning. So let's talk about it now. I mean, I almost feel like if Elon were a saner, more careful, and obviously compassionate person with the same enormous platform, no matter how judiciously he could have made this discovery and tried to perform an exorcism on it, it would have had a similar effect of just all of a sudden tens of millions of people who never heard about this thing just hearing about it for the first time, and the social media algorithm would have done its mad work, and it would have seemed like no one had ever talked about this before, and all of a sudden this now has to bend British politics in this moment, even though British politics seems to think this has all been priced in for now more than a decade.
I think there is a really fair point there in what you're saying, which is we're very bad at holding people to account for systemic failures. There were various resignations of councillors and things like that, but now one of the things that's being introduced is mandatory reporting. So the idea, if you see something like this happening, you are under a legal obligation to do it. And that's been around, as I understand it, for a while in America. That seems to me to be a straightforwardly good change. But you know, I can think of how little justice there's been over something like the football stadium disasters, like Hillsborough, which is also the subject of a big inquiry, or Grenfell, the tower that burned down. And now it looks like you know, we have all these tower blocks in Britain covered with cladding that is unsafe. Well, hang a minute, who certified it as being safe? You know, somewhere along the line, these systemic failures have led. We've had inquiries over things like train crashes. We are very bad at kind of apportioning blame in those circumstances like that. I think the difficulty that I have is that I think there are interesting things to be said about culture and ethnicity and the concept of this, and about whether or not that some people who come from parts of the world that have, where there might be Sharia or other types of law that are deeply inherently misogynistic, whether or not they bring those cultures with them to Britain. The difficulty is, as I said, only last week, as we're talking about this, there were convictions of a grooming gang in Glasgow, which was entirely filled with white Scottish people. They took kids to a house that the child nicknamed the Beastie Den, where they were also selling drugs, and raped them. And what's the cultural explanation for why they did it? You know, I think we have to say that culture obviously influenced some of these people, not least in how they got away with it, right? Not least in the way that they formed networks that were based around ethnicity. But this is not a kind of unique evil to the British Pakistani community or to Islam. I think that, you know, I mean, you've spoken very, you know, very strongly about Islamism and about some of the misogyny that is inherent to extreme forms of Islam. But I think it comes back to what you were saying about why can't we treat people as individuals? I think there is a feeling that the vast majority of British Muslims would have nothing to do with this sort of thing, would absolutely abhor anything like this. And to what extent can we draw wider lessons from the ethnicity of these men? I think that's the really sore spot. And it's not a question I necessarily have the answer to about the way to talk about that. I just think that one of the reasons that liberals are so tense about it is the feeling that they're being asked essentially to sign up to the Douglas Murray view, which is that, you know, Islam has no place in Europe. And that's the sort of shadow argument that's just out of sight. That in a way, maybe people would feel better if it was just out in the open and we were having that argument. But that, you know, that's lurking somewhere in the background unacknowledged.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't, it's been a while since I've spoken to Douglas on this topic. I don't think he would necessarily sign on the dotted line there. I think there probably is a little daylight between him and somebody like Geert Wilders. And say that Islam has no place in Europe.
I mean,
there are gradations here. You know, you have jihadism, you have Islamism, you have conservative Islam, you have some versions of liberal and even secular Islam, no doubt. And then you have the phenomenon of ex-Muslims who, you know, have all of the cultural background of the former categories, but are no longer believe in the faith, and they're some of the most embattled people in any society because it's, you know, apostasy is punishable by death if you're at all doctrinaire there. So it's, yeah, I'll let you hash that out with Douglas, but I'm not sure he would agree.
I don't mean to overstate his position, but you know what I mean is that is the argument that people feel is lurking behind it, which is the sense that this is a kind of alien culture. And that letting it into Europe was a mistake. And I think that's what people feel is what makes them uncomfortable, is drawing too broad conclusions from very specific local
situations. The problem there is just, it is, again, a statistical one. If you tell me, it's statistical in the sense that, you know, 100% of jihadists are Muslim, right? So it's like, if I'm worried about jihadism and you tell me, you know, I can know one thing about a person, when deciding whether to let them into my society, I'm going to ask whether they're Muslim, right? I mean, that's a natural way to filter against jihadism. And there are attitudes toward women that are enormously well subscribed in Islam. And they were very well subscribed in Christianity about, you know, 500 years ago, right? So there's historically contingent differences here, perhaps, and one could hope that Islam is reformable on these topics. But yeah, it's just, you know, you do a little opinion research on a variety of questions, and it's rarely consoling in the percentages who, you know, want to live under Sharia law or who think that, you know, homosexuality is a killing offense or et cetera, or who support suicide bombing in defense of the faith against non-combatants. I mean, you drill down on any particular ideas, whether you were a fan of the 7/7 bombing in London, it's easy to be worried that, again, it's a statistical argument. Like what percentage of Scientologists are at risk of becoming suicide bombers? It's very, very low. It might not be zero, but that's just not a thing with Scientology. Scientology has other things that you could well worry about. You know, it's certainly worth criticizing as a cult, but it would be worse if suicide bombing was part of its program, right? And Yeah, so it's...
I'm only smiling because I'm thinking back to what you said before, which is why can't you judge the person in front of you?
And well, I think well that, you can. The thing is, you can...
You know, this kind of talks to the problem of the fact we're never going to solve these questions about group versus individual because they are so complicated.
It's not complicated in it's just... it's hard to solve. So, I think you could absolutely treat everyone as an individual if you could get access to the information, really, right? So if you in an interview could decide reliably whether someone is a jihadist or they're just pretending not to be a jihadist so as to get into your country to perform an act of terrorism, right? Like if we had lie detectors that were as good as DNA reading machines, right? So like there's just no ambiguity as to whether you really are the person you say you are because we can, you know, we can reliably read your DNA. Well, now we can reliably detect whether you're lying about being a jihadist. Then I'm down with an individual screening of everybody. I mean, then there would no longer be any argument to care about group level ideological risk, in my view, because you'd be able to simply ask people, what do you believe? And they would tell you, and you would know whether they were lying. But,
yeah, whereas instead what you get is the U.S. visa form, you will never have had to fill in one of these, but you have to tick a box saying that you confirm that you were not involved in the Nazi genocide of 1934 to 1945,
Is which that is
just
one of those
where you just think, does that weed out a lot of people? But yeah, I take your point.
Yeah. All right. So coming to the final stretch here, how do we deal with the tension between freedom of speech and the obvious problem of misinformation and the empowerment of obvious bad actors who are eager to spread misinformation or outright lies? What do you do with as a journalist in interacting with this pseudo religion of so-called free speech absolutism? You know, again, Elon Musk is the fake avatar of this because he no sooner espouses it than he will deplatform somebody or demonetize them when he doesn't like what they say on the social media platform that he personally owns. But what do you do with this tension where we understand that sunlight is almost always the best disinfectant, that the antidote to bad ideas are good ideas, the antidote to fake journalism is real journalism, which is to say you should be free to talk about more or less anything, anywhere, and yet what we have built is a kind of hallucination machine where the most lurid and confabulatory and outright false and divisive and dangerous ideas seem to spread like wildfire, and the patient debunking of them spreads exactly nowhere. What should we do about all this, Helen?
Just a nice, easy one to finish. Yeah. Thank you. I think about this a lot, and I have to say it doesn't ever make me feel particularly optimistic when I do, because I think the bit that's broken is the idea of consequences. I think you're right, you should have a wide latitude to say things, but people should therefore be able to judge you appropriately on them. And from my point of view, if I got something catastrophically wrong, it would harm my career, right? There would be severe personal and professional consequences for doing so. And the problem I see particularly with, you know, anonymous social media is there are no consequences. There are no consequences for starting a rumor that ruins someone else's life. There are no consequences for spreading a conspiracy theory about why Paul Pelosi was attacked in his home and then just deleting it when you kind of can't back it up.
It's not even anonymous social media. There's no consequences for someone like Elon Musk, right? Like as you move right of center, certainly in American politics, the consequence of getting your facts wrong, even in a way that materially harms people. I mean, even to the point where you've accused someone of being a pedophile who quite obviously wasn't, and they now have to leave their home because you've turned your fanatical mob on them and they've been doxxed. There are no reputational, much less, you know, civil or criminal consequences for that. It's just more fun. There's just more lulls in your X feed.
That's the bit I find really worrying, because one of my colleagues said this to me this week. I think about Eric Adams, the New York mayor, about, you know, wait until he gets into real legal trouble. You can see already he's creeping towards MAGA.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very true, right? You look at Russell Brand, who I worked with as a New Statesman guest editor, and I should have seen him coming a little bit more than I did, who turned to Jesus very coincidentally about the time that he was, you know, had to leave Britain because of a series of sexual assault allegations against him. I think that that's one of the things that is very most worrying to me about the MAGA movement is the kind of you know, I can see why it started out as a coalition of the cancelled. And you and I have both spoken about the way we feel that the left has been censorious and kind of totalitarian in some ways. But it has created a really unhealthy dynamic in which the idea is now that, you know, nothing, there are no standards, no standards at all. And all you need to do is just say your allegiance to the kind of the MAGA flag. And at that point, you don't have to obey the same rules as everybody else. And so as a, you know, unsurprising, therefore, it has attracted some of the most unsavory people you could possibly meet. Ultimately, the only cure for that is by people rejecting it. And that's why, you know, the Atlantic is doing well, right? It's got over 1 million subscribers. And that's because people like what I think it is doing, which is talking about, you know, the problems on both the left and the right. It's not a deeply partisan operation. It's not, you know, it's not a pro-Trump as much as it is a pro-left wing. You know, it's obviously more sympathetic to the Democrats than it is to the Republicans at this point. But it does, it still will carry an enormous amount of criticism of where it thinks the Democrats have got things wrong. And people, there are lots of people who have spoken with their wallets to say that that is what they want. And I think that's the bit where, this is why I think what you've done with your Substack and Patreon is important. People want to be able to, in the same way they would have once paid their dues to a labor union, they want to pay their dues to create the kind of media that they want to see in the world. And I think that's a bit that we have to encourage, because the ad-funded model has just completely failed to deliver proper accountability journalism.
Yeah.
And the attention economy has similarly failed. And so the rebuilding of those institutions comes from people caring enough about them to invest in them and make a financial contribution to them. And the other bit, which we haven't really kind of got to talking about, I don't know if you've been following the Democratic National Committee elections, which seemed to me to prove that that party is not yet ready to get out of its, you know, voyage out from the shores of sanity into the wild fringes of madness quite yet. But at some point they do need to go, we'd actually like to get back into the business of winning elections. And that involves us compromising with the electorate that actually exists in the America that, you know, that is here now, not the one we'd like it to be. And at some point, I'm sure that will happen. It happened in the UK. You know, we had a Labour Party here, our centre-left party, that elected Jeremy Corbyn, who was a fringe anti-colonialist, who, you know, wasn't at all interested in the gender stuff, but inevitably picked it up as one of a suite of opinions and was declaring his pronouns in, you know, 2019, the same as anybody else. And what happened was that he lost so badly that the party went away, and under a new leader, Keir Starmer, who's now our Prime Minister, went, okay, there are some things here we have to say. People want us to be tough on immigration. You know, they want to feel they can trust our borders. People want to feel that we understand that science exists and biology exists. And sure enough, he came with a platform. It might not be a very inspirational platform, but it was one that reflected where the majority of Britain is. And as a result, he won an enormous majority. You know, it is not that long ago. It's only 2008 since Barack Obama won, you know, a majority in America, which we're told was, you know, much less enlightened than the one that we have, you know, now. These things aren't kind of completely impossible. They just have to be fought for really aggressively. And the bit that worries me about the Democrats at the moment is I just, at the moment, they seem to be so focused on their internal battles that they don't want to seem to talk to the America that they actually hope to govern and hope to get the votes for. But at some point, surely that will happen. I can only hope.
Yeah, no, I share that concern. I mean, I've yet to meet somebody kind of high up in the echelons of Democratic politics who is still woke. I mean, these are like private conversations, but everyone, the spell is broken for every major donor or name brand politician I have come across in really even before the election. But convincing everyone all at once that the activists don't have to be listened to is a coordination problem that we have to solve. But it was never more, I'm convinced it was never more than a tiny percentage. I mean, probably still a single digit percentage of the party that really truly believed most of these things. But they were so loud, and the reputational consequences of crossing them were so excruciating that everyone just fell into line, right? Everyone just put the black square on their Twitter bio and declared their pronouns and decided, okay, I can keep my head down and it'll still work. It's just important we don't have Trump in the White House. But it's, I can't imagine Kamala Harris.
I think Kamala Harris
is especially woke at the moment.
I think Kamala Harris realized that, right? Right, but she, I mean, I covered the election, so I saw a lot of the election material, and her whole, she was trying to frame herself as, you know, Trump's a threat to democracy, which I don't think ever really connected with that many people. It was too abstract an argument, too far away from where they lived. But also that she's a prosecutor. She puts down bad guys. They, you know, the thing that gets thrown at me when I've been writing about this in the last couple of months is they didn't make a big deal out of this stuff. They weren't talking all the time about gender. And you're like, right, because they had come, as you say, privately to the realization, yeah. Oh, this is toxic electoral poison. What they didn't have a way is going, by the way, just to let you know, guys, when I was saying this stuff in 2019, I didn't believe it. I was just saying that because that's what you had to get on in the Democratic primary.
Yeah.
Right. What they need to be very careful to do is pick the leader next time around who does not carry that baggage.
Right.
Right. Which is why Maddie Glazes wrote a very good piece saying, throw Biden under the bus, which is the test one of seriousness for the next Democratic leader. Mm-hmm. Maybe they can't do it during the primary, during the electorate bit, but they shouldn't be heading into the election going, that guy could have served a third term. He could have been governing until he was 120. You know, and the other thing is, I think Gavin Newsom has got really big problems because California has been ground zero for a lot of the gender stuff. In order to win anything in California, you have to appeal to your left flank. It is not like becoming the governor of a swing state where you have to be much more sensitive to pressure from both sides. And I just think, you know, if they go into 2028 with another California politician with a huge load of baggage, then I'm not saying that America deserves what it gets, but I just think at that point you think, I said this to my boss, I just think like at that point you're like a giant panda. It's like, do you even want to live?
Mm.
You know, do you want to survive? Someone needs to, you know, these people really need to decide that the thing that got to me, right, was the argument about the fact that this is existential, that Trump is a threat to our democracy, versus the revealed preference of, I don't want to ruin my career by saying Biden is too old.
Right.
I don't want to be the one that takes... If you really genuinely think that this guy is, you know, he's Hitler in the 1930s, but you think, yes, but this is going to cause me an awful lot of, you know, trouble in my primary if I say something about the guy running against him not being up to it, then you don't... Either you don't really care about the future of America or you don't believe what you're telling everybody else.
Hmm.
And I think that's the bit of the hollowness that lots of voters just sniffed, right? They just, you're not acting like people who believe this thing that you're saying is true.
Yeah. I mean, I think there was a path for Kamala or really any politician to disavow the pieties that they espoused in 2019 or 2020. I mean, you just need to be able to rationally articulate how your views have changed. I mean, even if they were sincerely held, let's imagine they were sincerely held at the time, you can certainly make the case that you've learned a lot in the intervening years and take, you know, trans activism as the most dangerous third rail, at least for Kamala Harris this time around. You could easily say, listen, this issue is way more complicated than I realized 4 years ago, right? It's not even a single issue. And you could actually, you could be fairly verbose on, as you know, we've been in this podcast, and take your foot out of your mouth and I think still be politically viable. It just has to be, you have to be free to offend the fringe of the fringe that will be offended by anything you say that's not just a pure genuflection to their, you know, religious conviction.
Yeah. I mean, I think they probably correctly intuited they couldn't do that in 3 months.
Yeah.
And I think that's the bit where I think I forgive the tactical team on that one. But you're right. They have now got 4 years in which to do that, if we assume that America will have, you know, another election as on schedule. So, it cannot be beyond the wit of man to do it. Keir Starmer did it. And people who are on the left really hate him for it, right? He chucked Jeremy Corbyn out of the party over the anti-Semitism blind spot that he had. And he has, you know, overseen the changing of the... You know, for example, Wes Streeting, the health secretary, has come out and said, you know, puberty blockers are banned except for in research trials. And, you know, that annoys people like me because they didn't do the bit where they said, and by the way, Helen Lewis, you were right and you were right all along. And now fair enough, they didn't do that. But you know what? They did it. And people on the, you know, can say how terrible you turned, you changed your positions, blah, blah, blah. What matters in politics is you got to the right position eventually. You know, and how you got there, yeah, it's probably going to be messy and it's probably not really going to stand up to close scrutiny. But you went into the election with a set of reasonable policies that most people could felt that they could stand behind. And I just, that to me is that's the kind of thing that kind of gets me up in the morning as I try and wade through, as I'm sure you do, the kind of blizzard of incoming stuff that is happening.
Well, as always, the right wing is more forgiving on these topics. You can have your road to Damascus moment no matter what your backstory is. I mean, you can even have compared Trump to Hitler and still be his vice president.
Right.
That's quite amazing. Well, Helen, we covered a lot of ground here. It's great to finally get to talk to you, not just read you. What are you doing next? You mentioned you have a book coming out on genius. When does that come out?
That is coming out in the summer with Thesis, who are the the kind of problematics division, I guess, of Penguin.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really delighted to be published by them. Nice. And it as you know, we mentioned Elon Musk a lot tonight. It's about the idea about what society thinks of as special and the way that we have arguments about what we value through it and what we're prepared to tolerate. And that takes, you know, all the way through from the kind of romantic poets through to the kind of tortured artists and the way that they, you know, they get that amount of license through now to the idea of the tech disruptor. Mm. But all the way through it, the kind of central braiding thread is it's very unhealthy for people to decide that they belong to a special class of people and that every opinion that they have is worthwhile, not just on the subjects of their expertise. So I always feel slightly bad coming on a podcast and talking about such a range of topics, when I am sort of ideologically opposed to that, I suppose, but people will hopefully forgive me.
Yeah, well, let's talk about genius when the book comes out, because
okay.
I think I share your sense that having that concept is more, it produces more confusion than illumination on the, just even the nature of human intelligence. I mean, Elon is the perfect example of somebody who's widely described as a genius, who is so obviously not aware of his lack of aptitude for thinking clearly about certain topics, really a wide range of topics, that it deflates the whole category. I mean, it's just not,
Right, and that is not by no means rare. You know, I'm thinking about, I cover in the book William Shockley, you know, an undoubtedly gifted guy who won the Nobel Prize and went later on in life onto a race in IQ. And decided that he knew absolutely everything there was to know about this topic because he was a smart kind of person.
Yeah.
Or some of the other, Hans Eysenck, the very highly cited psychologist who did lots of work on IQ, who decided that, you know, the cancer maybe was caused by a cancer-prone personality rather than smoking.
Right.
And
right.
You will find in his writings the idea that, well, of course, you know, geniuses have to futz their research findings a little bit, you know? They can't be held by the rules that apply to mere mortals. And that's, which I think is what you're talking about in the case of Musk, is exactly the kind of poisonous thinking that I'm a special person, special rules apply to me, often does not lead people into the best places. But yes, I will talk to you about that with delight at some future point.
That particular problem is not going away. So,
right.
Great to meet you, Helen. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.